It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farad. Last week, the Wisconsin Indigenous Housing and Economic Development Corporation held their first ever conference in Buller.
The two-day event brought together entrepreneurs, tribal leaders, and other professionals to talk about economic development and housing in Wisconsin's indigenous communities.
Session topics included housing, clean energy, and cannabis, as well as the results of economic impact and housing studies.
We'll talk with the organization's CEO about key takeaways from the conference and get an update on tribal economic development in Wisconsin.
Fern Ori is the CEO of the Wisconsin Indigenous Housing and Economic Development Corporation and a member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. She's also CEO of her own consulting company, the Matriarch Group. Fern, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Before we dive into the event, can you tell us a little bit about the Wisconsin Indigenous Housing and Economic Development Corporation? What are the goals of the organization?
Our goals are to strengthen the financial sovereignty of our Native tribal-owned businesses, our tribal communities, and our individuals and families of member nations across the state.
And then set the scene for us. Who was gathered at this conference? What was the atmosphere like?
We had everything from tribal leaders to our Native entrepreneurs, along with practitioners and partners and investors, and some of your partners and friends in the state agencies like DOA and WEDC.
And who made this happen? Who convened this first ever summit?
The Wisconsin Indigenous Economic Development Corporation. We put this on as our first inaugural event and excited to have this event moving forward every year. We're going to round robin this onto every Wisconsin tribe's reservation. And we're excited to turn around and host this event this coming spring in 2025. Location and date to be determined.
You revealed at the event the results of a study your organization conducted on the economic impacts that Indigenous-led businesses and enterprises had across the state. This is the first of its kind outside of the gaming industry in particular. Can you talk about what led you to want to do this study and what you learned?
Absolutely. So normally when we do hear some of these impacts and things around Wisconsin Indian Country, a lot of it has to do with the gaming dollars and gaming functions. We wanted to showcase and do a deep dive of our Native entrepreneurs and all of the non-gaming enterprises within the tribes and showcase the landscape out there and really put together a small business directory of Native entrepreneurs that can be a live functioning document and something live on our website that people can access the landscape of what kind of Native owned businesses are out there. But being the first of its kind of this study, showing the impacts and showing the work that's being done in Wisconsin within our tribal communities, both entrepreneurial and with our tribal game non-gaming enterprise work.
I want to dig into both of those categories now, Fern. First of all, for tribal-owned businesses outside of gaming, can you give us a sense of the range of the kind of businesses we're talking about there?
Absolutely. We have businesses in Wisconsin that are either construction, consultant. There are our Native vendors that sell their crafts and jewelry. We have vendors and businesses that actually do fishing and own a company to sell their fishing or fish and products that they gather. There's just a plethora of businesses on every level, but those are kind of some of the range of things out there. We have a student loan coach that has a business. We have some beauty salon type businesses, and everybody's selling their indigenously cultivated products, whether it be wild rice, fish, anything in the forestry management services, logging and timber. So really a beautiful array of multiple diverse businesses across Wisconsin.
You mentioned that logging and timber. I remember some years back, I talked to somebody with the Menominee Tribe Enterprises about their sustainable forest products. And this is, I think, got over 100-year history here in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. The Menominee Tribal Forest is unique, I think, worldwide in their sustainable forestry practices. You can literally see their forest from space, which I think is unique in that sense as well. And just their indigenous practice of maintaining and cultivating that forest and keeping it alive in the sense of its sacredness as well. So really showcasing some of that work within these non-gaming enterprises within our state tribal communities.
We're talking with Fern Ori, CEO of the Wisconsin Indigenous Housing and Economic Development Corporation, talking about the impact of Native-owned businesses, tribal businesses here in Wisconsin, some of the challenges and opportunities there. One topic at your summit, Fern, was something familiar to a lot of Wisconsin communities: housing. Cities, small towns have trouble in many cases in Wisconsin when it comes to affordable housing, available housing. What is that looking like for Wisconsin's tribes?
We are so excited to unveil the fact that we are developing a Wisconsin Native Homeownership Coalition. We're here to strengthen affordable housing here in Wisconsin tribal communities. And this coalition is slated to be a regional coalition for the Great Lakes tribes. We're excited to promote growth in the sense of we need more housing stock. We need housing to be affordable. We also need our tribal people to be able to have opportunities to become a Native developer, a Native real estate agent, Native home inspectors, Native carpenters. So we want to build out that workforce development and opportunity in that sense as well, and have an opportunity for our tribes to be able to build their own homes in a quicker fashion. So this Wisconsin Native Homeownership Coalition, those are some of the charges that we plan to address as we develop this coalition. Right now we're in the formative stages. We're forming a steering committee. We also just completed a study that was really looking at identifying the gaps here in Wisconsin tribal communities in housing, and looking at asset mapping of what currently exists and how we can start formulating a plan to address these things. We also talked with one of our partners, Colin Price, who's putting on a project called Project Resi. He wants to build 10,000 homes and develop our people to become Native developers and have those tools and resources to be able to multiply the people that are working towards homeownership.
Another hot topic at the summit was tribal clean energy strategies. Could you talk a little bit about what's in progress and then some of the ideas for the future that came up?
Absolutely. So there are so many billions of dollars and opportunities out there in the clean energy space for our whole nation, not just Indian country, but we have a few partners that have really seized the opportunities out there in the clean energy space and bringing them into Wisconsin Indian country. There's a Solar for All initiative and a Clean Communities Investment Accelerator program. Some of our partners like the Native CDFI Network and the OWISTA Corporation and the tribes themselves are able to bring in funding and look at electrifying our communities along with that, using that for strengthening our homes to have solar power and other energy saving techniques. We want to make sure that the tribes are aware of these opportunities that we're bringing in through partners to be able to access these types of funding and bring them into Wisconsin tribal communities.
That's green energy. I also understand you have your eye on another green rush, cannabis and tribal cannabis initiatives. Again, a hot topic statewide, not just in tribal communities. What are you looking for there?
I love the fact that you said green rush, because I call both of these green rushes, right? Clean energy and cannabis and hemp initiatives. We have an awesome organization here in Wisconsin called the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association. And we are looking at trying to do policy work and really look at initiatives that are going on in other states where cannabis is legal, and especially on the tribal front, and see what tribes have done in their communities to seize this economic opportunity and bring it back to their people. It's a plant medicine. So we understand that in Wisconsin, no longer is it a question of when. It's not a question of if, mm-hmm. it's when. And so we want our tribes to be able to see what other tribes in other states are doing in that space so that they can be prepared and have their ducks in a row to look at seizing that economic opportunity. And, you know, also on the hemp front, right? So hemp is legal in Wisconsin. So talking about those initiatives as well, and how tribes can make that another economic development opportunity for their communities.
A more broad issue, Wisconsin has struggled with this some. When that entrepreneur comes up with a pitch, an idea, are there investors out there? Is there support out there to invest in those big ideas? When we're talking about tribal communities in Wisconsin, what does it look like? What are the challenges?
Oh, the challenges definitely are many, especially even from the ground up as a Native entrepreneur in building out business plans and financial management techniques and just staying the course and having that tenacity to power through those challenges. But what I love about Wisconsin Indigenous Housing and Economic Development Corporation and our partners, the Native CDFIs in Wisconsin, is we're here as this holistic ecosystem to help our Native entrepreneurs flourish and providing opportunities for accessing capital for their business, for accessing technical assistance to help them grow and understand what it takes to run a business. We're excited that we were able to offer elevator pitch contests at this event. We had three $1,000 prizes for some of our Native entrepreneurs to show their organization and do a pitch in front of the audience and win those prizes. We were also, with a generous grant from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, able to give out 32 small business grant awards to our Native-owned businesses. They got $5,000 each. And we're excited to do that again moving forward as we have partners and investors that want to pitch in to help us provide some opportunities for our business owners, including continuing to have pitch contests at our events, and also probably something even more robust like a Shark Tank style opportunity.
Fern, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Fern Ori, CEO of the Wisconsin Indigenous Housing and Economic Development Corporation, member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. She talked to us about the organization's first ever economic summit.
Coming up, the United Nations Climate Conference is underway, and a Wisconsin physician urges a focus on health in negotiating climate solutions.
If policymakers understand that it's a win-win, it's a win to stabilize climate, but also it's a win for population-wide health.
Improving health in the climate, that's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The United Nations annual climate conference gets underway today in Azerbaijan.
For the next 12 days at COP29, world leaders and delegates will try to figure out how to pay for damages of human-caused climate change, increase transparency in how countries reach their climate goals, impose rules on carbon credit trading, and more.
In a post to X, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says, once again, young people are taking the lead.
You are demanding action now, not later, and I'm on your side. Leaders must arrive in Baku with ambitions that match the urgency and scale of the challenge. Together, let's push leaders to deliver.
Last year, part of the conference looked into the effects of climate change on human health. Our next guest sees a big opportunity to put health at the center of climate negotiations.
Dr. Jonathan Patz is the Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor and the John P. Holton Endowed Chair of Health and the Environment at UW-Madison. Dr. Patz, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, Kate, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invite.
As these climate talks get underway, can you give us a preview of what COP29 will be focusing on, as well as some of the health conversations that might come up?
Well, in COP29, it's more of a financing theme, trying to get nations to agree to come up with enough money for loss and damages that are already occurring across the world. So there's a lot of focus on how to get to the finance. Now in COP28, the instrument for financing loss and damages was put into place with a $1 billion pledge to set up that infrastructure. But countries really are not stepping up to the plate as far as their promises from the Paris Agreement a long time ago, you know, providing $100 billion annually by the year 2020. That was the hope. We're not there. So that, there's a big focus on that in COP29. The other thing to point out, of course, I'm a health scientist. COP28 in Dubai last year, we call that the health conference of the parties. It was the first time ever that the conference of the parties dedicated a full day to highlight the centrality of health in the climate change discourse. And the head of the World Health Organization was there, and the head of the conference of the parties had sessions highlighting how important human health is. And so from that point of view, COP29 will continue on with that. The World Health Organization just yesterday released a special report for COP29. And the title of that report is Health is the Argument for Climate Action. Hmm. It starts off with the Director General of WHO reiterating that the climate crisis is a health crisis. And one quote I found interesting, he says, tackling climate change requires a radical shift in how we prioritize energy spending. Consider last year was a record-breaking year for fossil fuel subsidies. That's public money that is effectively exacerbating the climate crisis. And one other quote from the Director General, you know, thinking about nationally determined commitments to reduce our emissions, he said, and I quote, "We must not think of the commitments as an expenditure. These are investments in a healthier future."
But Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the Director General of the WHO, he also says in that report that the tools to meet these challenges are already at hand. They exist in the world. What does the WHO envision?
Well, you know, we recognize how important you know, reducing our fossil fuel emissions can benefit health right away when you think about the 8 million premature deaths from air pollution that occur around the world. 5 million of those are directly attributed to burning fossil fuels. In Wisconsin, actually, there was an analysis showing that if we could reduce our emissions and get to clean energy, the air pollution benefits would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,900 lives. Almost 2,000 lives could be saved every year in Wisconsin from the healthy air quality from that. So, you know, other aspects, how we design our cities is so important, thinking about sedentary lifestyle from too much dependence on private motorized vehicles. So we need to design cities more for people-powered transportation, bikes and walking. Certainly getting to more plant-forward diets would be both beneficial for our cardiovascular health, but also reduce the destruction of the rainforests, for example, to grow livestock. And a plant-forward diet would be much more environmentally friendly.
You are putting out a number of examples here, and you attended the COP28 last year in Dubai. And I'm just wondering, how do you move these efforts forward? How do you move the world around these types of changes 1 year later, even decades later?
Yeah, well, you know, I think we can't ignore the election that we just had and some expected change in direction. I think that we assume that the new administration will pull out of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, where we have these climate summits, as they did in 2016. But just as health is not a partisan issue. Climate change should not be a partisan issue, especially as you hear the Director General of the World Health Organization reiterating that the climate crisis is a health crisis. So, you know, the outcome of this election makes it that much more important for those of us in the health field to communicate the centrality of human health in discussions about climate change. There's more common ground around health than there is around environment. So I think this is something that we need to strengthen this messaging. There's a wonderful organization in Wisconsin, the Healthy Climate Wisconsin Group, which is doctors and nurses and other health professionals statewide that are talking to heads of hospitals, and there's a big movement in the healthcare arena to to take on climate change. The National Academy of Medicine has a grand challenge on climate change, health inequity, and this is something that they put as high priority. So I think that certainly the health community recognizes the priority that the climate challenge is for us. And I think, you know, pushing this as a nonpartisan issue is based around the science and the concern for our patients and the population at large, that I think we just need to continue to communicate this to people.
We are talking about climate change's impact on health as COP29, the annual United Nations Climate Conference, gets underway. Our guest is Dr. Jonathan Patz, a professor of health and the environment at UW-Madison. Dr. Patz, it sounds like there is more collaboration, more coordination going on here between different aspects and industries. The World Health Organization urging world leaders at COP29 to abandon, quote, the siloed approach to addressing climate change and health. What impact do you see in these silos or separate tracks to working out solutions to a warming planet?
In my area of public health, we take that very seriously. We have a new NIH center, and the center is called Health First Climate Action Research Center, showing how, you know, climate actions, be it in reducing emissions from electricity generation to designing better transportation that promotes physical fitness, green space for mental health. These are areas that are, they may be policies to reduce climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, but at the same time, they benefit our health. So there's a lot to be gained there. At COP29, you know, not only are they looking across sectors, but they're talking about getting to a zero carbon economy in an equitable way. They're talking about the just transition so that people, workers in fossil fuels will have places to go, other jobs. There are more green jobs than there are in fossil fuels. And the other thing that I noticed in the upcoming COP29 is that they want to put people at the center, ensuring climate action creates jobs, improves health.
It makes me think about the World Health Organization's report with its three overlapping circles of the Venn diagram of people, place, planet. All these things are interconnected.
Yes, they are absolutely interconnected. You know, we can't think about taking care of our health simply by medicines and hospitals. Our health depends on the health of natural resources and functioning ecosystems and a stable climate. And the other thing is that when we think about climate change, you know, it's, for me, it's, there's more opportunity than sacrifice, especially these days when the economics have changed. I mean, the cheapest way now to generate electricity is from renewables. So we're in a new era when we think of the price of energy. That wasn't true 5 or 10 years ago. So I think that, you know, it's hard to turn that back now that we are seeing how much cheaper it is to go with renewable energy, so that indeed the right choice can be the cheaper choice and the easier choice.
You've been at this a long time, studying global health, the impacts of climate, and over time you've shifted the perspective of your research from looking at the health problems that are caused by fossil fuels to considering the health benefits of cutting pollution. Can you explain that shift in mindset and focus and how it impacts research?
Kate, I'm glad you brought that up. I've actually rebranded my research group. We're called the Climate Solutions for Health Lab. And it's because I think that the health benefits of a low carbon economy are so enormous that to focus more on the health risks from climate change, of which there are many, the risks from heat waves to air pollution to infectious diseases, malnutrition, mental health risks. But when you look at the solutions, when you look at what happens when you have clean energy and you avoid 8 million premature deaths from clean energy, and when you avoid about 11 million deaths from unhealthy diets, especially high red meat diets. And when you look at the health benefits of 4 million people from having more active transportation, more walking and biking, those numbers add up. You know, that's almost a third to half of all premature deaths every year simply by getting to low carbon energy, food systems, and transportation. So I have shifted my focus because of the enormity of the health benefits of a low carbon economy, that I think that's where we can shift policy a little faster. You don't even have to believe in climate science to recognize the health benefits of clean air, healthier diets, and cities designed more for people that promote physical fitness. That's something that everyone should be able to agree on, no matter what their beliefs in climate are, no matter what their political ideology is. I mean, again, this is not a political issue. This is about our health. Mm-hmm. And so I think that this is where if policymakers understand that it's a win-win, it's a win to stabilize climate, but also it's a win for population-wide health, that I hope that decisions can be made faster and be more lasting.
Dr. Patz, circling back to COP29 here, as the 11 days unfold, what will you be watching for most?
I think what I would most be watching for is the doubling down of all of the healthcare individuals and health organizations that are already involved with this negotiation to recognize their needed leadership in making sure that the health messaging is loud and clear coming into the COP29 meeting because of the political winds, especially in the United States, that the shifting in priorities that will happen soon. You know, the climate discourse needs to recognize the centrality of health, and health should not be politicized. I'd like to see, and I think I would expect, that anyone working in health would just increase the volume to make sure that decision makers understand that this is not something that is just about the environment and stabilizing the climate, it is absolutely about our health and our health today and the health of future generations.
Dr. Patz, thank you for joining us.
Oh, Kate, it's been a pleasure.
That was Dr. Jonathan Patz, a professor of health and the environment at UW-Madison. He talked with us about how CO2 pollution harms human health as the United Nations climate talks get underway today in Azerbaijan.
Hey, if you follow Wisconsin Public Radio on social media outlets, did you know that we have not one, but two separate Facebook feeds?
In addition to the one called Wisconsin Public Radio, you can also follow us at WPR Music, Arts, and Culture.
As that name suggests, the feed is less about the breaking news and the politics. It's all about things happening in creative culture around the state and people doing interesting things in communities all around the state, communities just like yours.
You can check it out, especially if you need a break from the news. Once again, it's WPR Music, Arts, and Culture on Facebook. Join the conversation.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a new documentary shines a light on the work of volunteer firefighters. We'll hear from the filmmaker and the fire chief for Cornell in northwestern Wisconsin.
It takes a lot of time, and you never know from day to day what the call is going to be.
That's coming up here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Of the 809 fire departments across Wisconsin, more than 75% are predominantly run by volunteers. That's according to the State Department of Safety and Professional Services.
And the Cornell Area Fire Department is one of them. The department serves 9 communities in northeast Chippewa County with a team of 30 people, all volunteers.
Volunteer firefighters can be unsung heroes, but the Cornell Department is featured in a new documentary produced by a filmmaker who grew up in the community.
Ben Cook is a filmmaker and editor from Wisconsin and director of the film. It's called The Best of Us. It premieres this weekend at the Wyawega International Film Festival. We also have Matt Boulding, fire chief of the Cornell Area Fire Department. He's highlighted in the film. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Ben, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Ben, you grew up in Cornell. What do you remember about the volunteer fire department there from your childhood?
I think my first encounters were with Denny. He was he's the town barber and was actually the chief for about 50 years before Matt took over. But Denny, when he went into his barber shop, there was always two things you kind of got with Denny. You'd get, when he walked in, he would have some kind of joke or something to get you at ease and put you at ease. And, something you would talk about the town or what was happening around town. He was always a good source of information. But also in the background was always a scanner. There was a scanner, whether it was the police band or the fire band, that was a constant thing. So as you were getting your haircut, you know, he'd be clipping along. And then, you know, if the scanner went off, he'd be mid-clip and he would stop, clap an ear to the scanner. And it was one of those things of, I guess as a kid, I didn't really realize. I thought this was maybe something that adults just had, and it was a common thing for most adults. I don't know. And I'd go to friends' houses, and sometimes scanners would be on over at friends' houses. And it wasn't until much later in life that I kind of put two and two together about volunteership and how these scanners are pretty much a very fixed part of their lives.
Matt, this is such a part of your life and it's part of your family. What made you enter into volunteer firefighting in Cornell?
I grew up with it. Always wanted to be a part of it. As long as I can remember, when the scanner would go off and the fire whistle would blow, I would be out on a street corner and watch fire trucks go out. My dad and brother were part of the department. My dad retired after 34 years, retired as an assistant chief. And my brother currently serves down in Texas as a captain on one of their departments. So it's been in the family our whole life.
Now, Ben, I know I've talked about it on the show in the past, how important volunteer fire departments are. I know they're volunteers, but I got to say, your documentary really brings it to life. What were you trying to show us about, you know, these real people, right? The barber or a shop owner or a wrestling coach or whatever, who volunteer their time to literally save lives?
I mean, when you think about volunteership, perhaps when you might initially think, well, they get a phone call and then they show up and then they answer the thing. That's not what it was. So it's dedication. It's 24/7. They've got these pagers on their hips. You know, they're constantly paying attention. I mean, for whatever time that they spend actually answering calls, they're listening to these scanners and they're paying attention to these pagers and it's just, you know, every little bleep, every little bloop. You know, when I was there filming for this I filmed in two portions, one portion in 2021 and then I went back in 2023, and when I went back, I actually carried around one of the pagers, and I think we got a call for a fire in Gilman at 2 a.m. and I jumped out of bed and, you know, race down to the fire station and went on the call with them. But every little bleep, every little bloop, you kind of stop what you're doing. And a big part of the kind of stylistic element of the movie is that, is the interruptions of daily life, is the amount these firefighters really give of their time, and how much sacrifice really, and the hope that they bring in what they're doing. It's amazing when you talk to a lot of people about volunteer firefighting and how they don't know that so much of the fire departments that are volunteer, and so much of the country is comprised of this. So that was really a big part of it. And I think getting the audience to understand, you know, who these people are, what they're giving up, with the context of their lives as much as we could, was really important to understand those kind of interruptions and those things that they go through.
And Matt, can you talk about the range of calls you might answer? I mean, obviously, you think firefighter, you fight fires, sure. You're first responders, though. There's a wide variety of things that lead you to get that call on your scanner. Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah, when a lot of people think we're just, you know, answer a fire call. We'd go out and assist our ambulance on EMS calls, you know, helping with patients that fall, need help picked back up, accidents, hunting accidents, ATV accidents. We're in rural Wisconsin, so we have tons and tons of off-road trails, snowmobile trails, water rescues. So there's a lot that goes into being a volunteer firefighter, and a lot of training hours that go into it, that, you know, it takes a lot of time, and you never know from day to day what the call is going to be.
Ben, you had mentioned a former fire chief, longtime fire chief in Cornell, Dennis Class. I want to give a listen to him talking a little bit about what changed over the course of his career.
When I first got on, we didn't have pagers. They had a siren. Not everybody heard the siren, which was a bad thing, depending on what direction the wind was out of.
Now, Matt, when Denny first started volunteering, I guess there was a waiting list of people trying to join in. That's changed now. There have been some ups and downs in getting people to sign on. Can you talk about what it's like to try to make sure you have enough people on the job?
Yes. When I took over as a chief in 2022, we had a very shortened roster. Denny always liked to maintain a 30-person roster for the fire department. And when Denny decided that 50 years was enough and was ready to retire, probably the hardest decision he had to make. We were down into the low 20s. And since 2022, we've been very fortunate. And we have been able to bring our roster back up to exceed the 30-person roster. And we're currently sitting at a 40-person roster right now. We're fortunate of that. Some of our neighboring departments, not so fortunate, but we are also sharing some of our members with some of the other neighboring departments that are short-staffed, traveling 12 miles north and assisting in the other county at Sheldon Fire Department. And some of them are shared with us from Jim Falls, Anson Fire Department, and we do have a couple that come up from Cadott to help us with our, to make our 40-person roster. So a lot of that comes back onto the dedication and what it takes to be a firefighter, the commitment you have to make, the schooling, the training, and to make that commitment and have a family at the same time, it's tough.
We're talking about a new documentary called The Best of Us. It's about the Cornell Area Fire Department, the volunteer firefighters, first responders who run it. We have the director, Ben Cook, and Fire Chief Matt Boulding with us. The documentary recounts some of the events that firefighters witness, car accidents, deaths of neighbors in some cases. Here's a listen to volunteer firefighter Tyler Burdick.
The worst one I probably went on was actually last year, and it was a mutual aid call with Sheldon. That was a... It was a triple fatal. It was a head-on crash, and one of the vehicles ended up on fire, and that one was probably the worst one up to date so far with me on that one. Well, the one individual did pass away in the fire in the fiery vehicle one. So that one, I guess that was new to me, so that one kind of hit me pretty hard, but
Matt, I mean, you and your fellow first responders there, you respond to the worst. You might be the first person to see somebody after a traffic crash or a fire or the long list of things you respond to. How do you and your colleagues deal with these traumatic experiences?
One of the biggest things is talking with each other. In the county, we have a support team that comes out and goes to different areas, and they're just a phone call away. Within hours after an incident, they can be here set up and debriefing the whole team that was on that scene. And the biggest thing is to talk about it, get it out, and move on with it.
Ben, you watched, you heard all of these firefighters talk about these experiences. What struck you about how they handled these really difficult situations that I think most of us would want to avoid in life?
I was impressed, obviously, with their ability to cope and compartmentalize and just do the job as, you know, no matter what the situation was, they can put it in the back of their mind, whether it's a neighbor, whether it's a family member, maybe whether it's somebody else that they don't know. They really know how to deal with these things appropriately. And I cannot imagine what that would be like to constantly wait for that tone to drop.
Many of the people involved in volunteer firefighting are men, but there's a female firefighter you've got in the documentary at Cornell talking about her experience. This is the voice of Kaylee Westaby.
It was a little intimidating, but you can't, as a woman, I always tell myself, you can't go in expecting people to treat you different because you are a female. You're coming to do a job as a firefighter, and this isn't about you. This is life or death for other people.
And Matt, in the documentary, you talk about, you know, women being as good as, in some cases, even maybe better at the job than men. I think when people think of recruiting volunteer firefighters, they might be thinking men. What would you say to say, hey, hold on, women should think about that too?
There's a place for men and women on the fire department. We're currently sitting with three female firefighters. In instance, we've had calls where I was the first one on scene and couldn't make the connection with some children that were on a scene. And I knew One of my female firefighters, Kaylee, was close to arriving on scene, and I radioed for her to come right to me as soon as she got there. And by having that female on scene right away and part of our department, she was able to make the connection and find out the injuries and what had happened to get to have that accident happen, how it happened. They were just, some people just open up more to females. They're a little bit softer spoken. And the way I look at it is, you know, females mature faster. And also, they respect the equipment a little bit more.
Ben, this is a documentary about volunteer firefighting in Cornell, but I feel like it's a lot more than that. I mean, it's inspiring, I gotta say, to see people stepping up in their community, unsung, I think, in a lot of ways, no reward particularly for it. What did you take away from this in terms of just people doing things to help the people around them?
I haven't lived in Cornell since I was 18. You know, I went off and I lived in LA for 15 years. And it's kind of, when you live in big cities, sometimes you get a little disconnected with people around you. I think when I went back and started making this, I realized that the town I grew up in has a special kind of glue that holds it together. And that's why they have a 40-person roster now, where other places have shortfalls. And that's why, you know, they're expanding and adding another satellite station. My hometown has a really strong bond, and I was amazed by it.
Matt, I gotta ask, what is it that keeps you coming back? What has made this such an important thing for your life?
I've always wanted to just make a difference. I've just wanted to be there to help. It's always been a dream to lead. I didn't think it would happen as soon as it did. Denny left extremely big shoes to fill. Denny did an outstanding job in his 50 years of service with this department. And I just hope that during my time, I can continue to do the same and keep making the improvements we need to keep the department running as strong as Denny did through his time.
Well, Matt, I don't want to embarrass you, but watching this, you're a rock star, man. And thank you so much for the work you do. I can tell your community appreciates it. And I hope everybody appreciates their community firefighters.
Thank you.
We'll leave it there. And Ben, thank you so much for sharing the documentary with us.
Thank you guys for showcasing it for us. And to the listeners, if you can go down to your volunteer fire station, go down to your fire station, say hello, you know, see if they need someone, thank them, you know. If you can put in anything at all, just please go down.
That's Ben Cook, filmmaker and editor from Wisconsin. His most recent film is The Best of Us, about the lives of volunteer firefighters in Cornell. We also heard from Matt Boulding, fire chief of the Cornell Area Fire Department. The Best of Us recently won Best Feature Documentary at the Madison Film Festival. It screens at the Wyawega Film Festival on November 14th. To find more showtimes, visit Folk Cinema on Facebook. As the nation marks Veterans Day, we want to highlight a series of conversations we've got going on here at Wisconsin Today.
On Friday, we heard about a new album by a Wisconsin band inspired by the experiences of Wisconsin men and women who served during World War I.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear about ongoing efforts in Wisconsin to help veterans deal with mental health concerns and a program that uses horses as part of therapy.
And later this week, we'll hear the World War II story of the Red Arrow Division, formed from National Guard units in Wisconsin and Michigan.
We want to hear from you. Is there a story related to veterans that you want to share, or something you want to learn more about involving Wisconsinites at war and afterward? You could inspire a future conversation here on the show.
Let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text us at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.